Hi, this is Tavi Greiner, Astronomy.fm's Vice President of Communications. If you enjoy our programming, please let us know with a donation to astronomy.fm/donate. We really do rely on your support, and it's true, every little bit counts.
AFM.
Program complete. Enter when ready.
The curtain of night is drawn back. The telescopes are trained. The domes are open. The audience is set. Now, step into the event horizon.
Hello and good evening, everyone. Welcome to Friday night's Event Horizon. It is 9 p.m. That's 2100 hours Eastern Standard Time. And that is 0100 hours GMT. Unfortunately, Marty is in the brig. He has completely and utterly upset the first officer and with his suggestions about plumic soup. So, sorry, folks, no Marty for tonight. However, I have gone one better than Marty. I have my, well, I have our
greatest... Don't say better. Don't say better. Marty's having fun. Marty is at work playing with a telescope.
Yes, Marty's all like at Cranbrook playing with the telescopes. Might as well. If he's in the brig, he can be doing that, can't he? But, yeah, no Marty this week, folks. It's just, it's me and John. We are going to have some fun.
I've got 10 o'clock here.
You've got 10 o'clock in Newfoundland?
New Brunswick, 10:30 in Newfoundland. Yeah, 10:30 in Newfoundland.
Yeah. And, of course, what does the O stand for in the clock? Oh, my God, it's early. So, yes, we are here. We are live. Please join the chat room. The show notes will have the links. So once we get the podcast after the show notes will be up. And if you're listening to the podcast, you can follow the links at the same time, and you'll see everything we saw and we discussed in the chat room. Now, some interesting developments. As some people know, there was a telescope in the Tenerife on Mount Teide, which belonged to Bradford University in the United Kingdom. And it was the Bradford Telescope, and it has sadly gone down. In fact, what has happened, it has transferred ownership. The Open University in the United Kingdom has taken over the Bradford Robotic Telescope. They have been trying to bring it back. They gave it a new name, ART, and they did their best. So we are still hoping to see that it may come back. If you've had an account with them and you transferred it to the Open University, you will still be able to access all your images and stuff. But you know what? It's nice. They're putting in new telescopes in this day and age on the Canary Islands. So I'll put the first link in, and that will take you to Ed's telescope blog. And, of course, the pirate data, they have a pirate telescope on Mount Teide. I'm sure Marty would enjoy that one. And they're actually doing follow-up work on Gaia. And, of course, the other great thing about it is they're putting a new telescope in. Now, it is going to be... I'm just trying to pull myself back to the original page on this because... Well, they've called it COAST. The new telescope is going to be called COAST, and it is the completely autonomous telescope. So the Open University has two domes. It will be the existing remote telescope, Pirate, and the completely autonomous telescope. Now, the OU has been operating the Pirate telescope remotely for 6 years. It is used more for research and education programs, and the new COAST facility will operate very much in a similar way to the old Bradford Robotic Telescope after a period of commissioning and testing. Observations will be can be requested by telescope.org. They will feed into COAST instead of ART, and it's their intention to have a near identical equipment set up to ART. So they're reusing several of the cameras, and they're going to be 14-inch reflectors. Now, I believe
did you say something about putting bigger cameras in? Or well, they're reusing these ones, are they?
They're reusing the original equipment, some of the original equipment. Now, they had some very, very good cameras when it was the Bradford Robotic. I've used it. I still have an account there. I did transfer my account over to the OU so that I could continue using it.
It take like 24 hours to get your image?
It does, yeah. You put
yeah, not bad. Yeah, put your request in. They send in your image, yeah.
Yeah. And the nice thing is, depending on the time of year, you can actually queue stuff, and I used to queue constellations, that's why. Somewhere in my picture file, I have an image of the sit of Cygnus, I have the moon, I have the planets, and I have some of the more easy reachable deep sky objects. And it's going to be available to the public. You sign up for an account, you take out a subscription, once everything's back up and running, and you task it. It's not live like some of the...
No, you're still going to have your 24 hours or
yeah,
put in your request, yeah.
But one of the things that they have said, if there is a school use or an educational use, that will get priority. Exactly the same way as it used to be with the old Bradford telescope.
Yeah, I want to thank Mark in the chat room for Black Projects.
Oh, no, he's got a very nice setup.
Thank you, Mark. Yeah, he's talking about it's a 33.5 centimeter scope. He says you can get your request done in 12 hours if it's a comet.
Yeah. And
if you're working on a project,
if
you're
a planet, you can get a wide field image. Oh, so, excellent. Yeah, it's going to be fun. And the nice thing is it won't be as costly as some of the other remote telescopes. And I think that's why they've said you're going to be queued. But you can live with that. If you're just looking for a picture of, say, a comet, a planet, or a constellation, then you can live with it. But as I say, it's nice to see money being put into imaging observatories, and B, observatories that will have access for the general public. Obviously, a lot of OU students will get priority. And as
right
Mark
now, they'd probably be pointing them at the Novas, the two new Novas if they had them up and running.
Yeah, they would be.
Black Projects, thank you for the heads up on that.
Yeah, I think one of them, as I remember, was in Sagittarius, just near the teapot asterism. So it would be great. It will give a lot of people a lot more access. Now, the other thing that has been brought to my attention is the fact that we're actually getting closer to an actual launch of Orion. They're now talking about... I've just got to dive back in and find the link, because I was looking at it earlier. Here we go. The NASA and the US Navy have been practicing for the recovery of the very first Orion mission. So let me get this put into chat. Okay. Now, obviously, they've learned from it's much easier to land a capsule in the water and recover it. It's a lot better on the astronauts because you haven't got a bone-jarring crunch at the end of your journey. So what they've been doing is they've been using one of the amphibious assault ships to let the capsule out through the rear doors of the ship, and then they're coming along to recover it. Great. First flight for the whole system is supposed to be September 18th. Thank you, Black Projects, for the heads up there on that. So fingers crossed and touch wood, it all comes off well, because we need to get this man rated. We are stuck in low Earth orbit. We're twiddling our thumbs until Orion comes along. We need SLS, and we need people like ESA to look at man rating the next generation of Ariane launchers, because the more facilities we have, the more options we have. At the end of the day, it is going to make manned spaceflight so much easier. And, of course, it means should there be an incident, it would make recovery of the astronauts alive so much easier. Back in the days of Skylab, we had a modified Saturn on the launch pad They had a modified command module. They took out all the stowage on the module. They turned it from a 3-seater to a 5-seater. That was great. That means you had two pilots, pilot, co-pilot, and space for the three crew members of Skylab. And to be honest, that's where a lot of the ideas for Orion came from just using that whole procedure. You know what? It's great. I love Apollo, the space program that's still giving. So,
I think you're looking for a rerun of 1960s TV.
No, thanks.
I wonder if this will land on I Dream of Genie.
Wouldn't that be nice? But
yeah, I'm not one of those manned space flight enthusiasts.
I'd like to see.
I've always been on the other side. Have fun trying to get off the planet. You know, enjoy yourselves. But
I want to get to Mars. I want us to get to Mars. I want us to put the Mark One eyeball on Mars. Now, BP also points out that Ariane V may get man-rated if the mini shuttle gets on top of the machine. That would be excellent too. And of course, we've got some other projects which are coming into play. Dream Chaser. They're all out there. You've got Musk, who wants to go to Mars. Bezos wants to go to Mars. And of course, that makes life a lot easier for the national space programs, because it's not just a case of the country doing it, it's industry doing it. So,
well, let's see if they get there first.
Yeah,
I'm going to Mars. You got any boxes? Anybody can say they're going to Mars, you know?
Yeah. Right. Well, when they get there, Scotty up.
They get there all up in the scotch.
Yeah.
No, Mars. What NASA say to them? Say if go ahead, go first. It's not a race.
Yeah, to them it isn't. It's they like the multiple options, the multiple routes.
Well, I think NASA has something about reality kicking in.
Yeah, they do.
It's a lot of work to get to Mars.
It was a lot of work to get to the moon, and they've been putting a lot of their resources recently into the ISS. Once we can move on a safer spot in orbit. Yeah, Mars is hard. Everything worthwhile is hard. I think Starship wants me to say something. Hang on a second.
You're probably saying you're dropping out. You're talking too close to your microphone.
No, actually, she's... oh, I'm dropping out. Okay. That's odd.
No, you're doing fine. You were just a little close to the mic. It was overpowering it. There, you're good.
My connection's slightly good.
Okay, no, you're good. Good.
Now,
UPI had a lot of good stories there, didn't they?
Pardon?
UPI has a lot of good stories in their
science page. Oh, yes, it does. It does. Let's move away from Orion now. Now, the other thing...
You want to get off the planet with your dreams. Every week I can hear it.
I'm being reminded that on Monday the 14th, Nat Geo has their docudrama about going to Mars.
That'll be cool.
Set your DVRs if you can.
Say it again, Mariah.
Set your DVRs if you can.
There you go. You got it from the expert. Okay, so the next story is the egg rock on Mars.
That was pretty cool.
Yeah.
So that's a different composition than what we pick up here on Earth.
Yep. Okay, so the link's in the chat room, and I just got to find where my story went. Oh, there we go. Now, Mars may have actually sampled a completely different population than the Earth has. This is what researcher Horton Newscombe thinks. And the Curiosity has identified the identity of a small metallic globule spotted last week in images by scientists on the mast cam. And chemical analysis suggests that it's an iron nickel meteorite. So, it's a dark, smooth, and lustrous object aspect of this target, and it's sort of spherical-shaped. That attracted the attention of some of the MSL scientists when they received the mast cam images at the new location.
Stands right out, doesn't it?
Pardon?
It stands right out.
Yeah, it does. If you actually look at the picture, it is you can't miss it.
against the red background.
Yep, and it's on its way up Mount Sharp at the moment, is Curiosity. And this thing is just sitting there. It's almost saying, you guys can't really miss me, can you?
Well, they think it's evidence of a likely origin. It's inside a molten core of a melting asteroid. So that needs atmosphere.
Yeah. Now, the scientists on the mission instructed the rover to use its laser-powered ChemCam. So
that
the instrument,
cool, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Laser-powered.
They used a series of laser pulses at the meteorite from various angles, and the initial readings suggest the presence of iron, nickel, and phosphorus, a common trifractor in iron, nickel meteorites. Now, yeah, as you said, the likely origin is inside the molten core of a melting asteroid. So this is something I don't think we've seen very much of on Earth. I don't think we've really seen that at all on Earth at all.
No.
And certainly not that shape, as I'm being told.
Yeah, that's a combination of atmosphere, its interaction with the...
Now, what they want to do, they want to compare the egg rock to samples found elsewhere on Mars and to samples found here on Earth. Now, this is the really sad thing about Schiaparelli.
It gives us a better idea of our makeup of our solar system.
It does, yeah. I totally agree. And I think the really sad thing is if the technology demonstrator that was Schiaparelli had worked, we would be quite a few steps forward to an actual physical Mars return mission. Because that was one of the things they really wanted to try out.
How much that little guy weighs, though.
They don't actually say.
No, they don't give a guesstimate.
No, they don't even guesstimate it, but...
But I'm just looking. We have to be looking at an image in case to let the listeners know. We're looking at an image and trying to compare it to just a basic background. It's
so,
sitting on a red background with a white seam and dust, and it's just gray copper or gray bra, shiny gray sticks right out.
And the actual rock around it is like marbled. You know what? If you take a nice piece of beef,
you see a couple of burn stripes in it.
Pardon?
You see a couple of burn streaks in it.
Yeah. Now, is that post chem cam or pre chem cam?
You'd have to dig that out.
Maybe this should be a target for a map for when we actually get there. Is to go and visit this piece of rock and to bring it home for further analysis.
They have found some interesting things, haven't they? At least this one isn't shaped like a frog or something.
Oh, yeah.
I think they must have found a frog on Mars by now, haven't they? They found everything else.
Nah, no frogs yet.
Mouse, Bigfoot, wasn't it? Didn't they find Bigfoot on Mars?
Yeah, they found a pyramid as well. And it
at least
was
this
all
is more, this is better.
Always is much, much better.
Yeah.
And to be honest, maybe perhaps the first manned mission to Mars should go to Mount Sharp and collect this oddity and bring it home. But who knows?
You know what, Nick? Somebody in the future right now, if they want to go back in history and check, and they'll hear us talking with that rock, and they'll be holding that rock up in their hand.
Yeah.
Maybe 100 years from now, maybe 50, maybe 20. But somebody will go over there and pick that rock up.
Yeah.
Because it was already imaged.
But maybe we set a precedent. We're talking about it. There's an image up there. NASA has probably got this little notation. Must collect.
Somebody should be picking it up.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure somebody will. And if it's not a scientist, it will be a rock collector, a geologist. And it will probably end up in somebody's collection somewhere. Somehow, somewhere, yes, quite right. And of course, now another interesting story. Now this link, this series of links, are courtesy of John because he showed me the main link before the show. And there's a cosmic ray detector finds possible crack in the Earth's magnetic shield. Before we go any further, I am going to invoke Corporal Jones. Don't panic. Okay, so.
Would you pick that one up on UPI?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, so, let me try that link again because it's got a hashtag against it and it didn't like it. That's better. Right, so what has happened? Obviously, we owe our life to the magnetosphere. We have that to thank for it. But the latest research is of the fact it's not a fail-safe shield. Because the world's most sensitive cosmic ray detector is in India, and it thinks it's identified a potential crack in the Earth's magnetic field. The weakness was revealed by a burst of galactic cosmic rays detected by GRAPES 3 back in June 1915. Sorry, 2015. I might say 1915. I want to do time traveling.
We'll get there someday.
Yeah.
But anyway, back during the severe magnetic storm in June 2015, the GRAPES 3 detector revealed a weakness. Now, the storm was triggered by a plasma cloud ejected from the sun's corona. Now, it was one of the largest geomagnetic storms in recent history, generating an intense aurora borealis. And it basically pretty much wiped out radio communications for most of the northern latitudes. In fact, it was strong enough to compress the Earth's magnetosphere for several hours. Now, the GRAPES 3 Muon telescope is a massive array situated in southern India. It's a joint effort among scientific institutes in Japan and India. And the data is revealing the cosmic ray breach was analyzed by scientists at the Tata Institute of Fundamental Research in Mumbai. And they've only just now published their analysis of the potential crack this week. Hence the delay. Obviously, if you find something like this, you do really want to be sure of your facts before you go public, because otherwise you get egg on your face if you find something.
Well, it also means cosmic rays come closer before they break up.
Yeah.
In the atmosphere. And the shower of particles, you get higher energy particles showering on top of the Earth closer.
That's right.
Because these muons come in quite high, mm-hmm. and they break up. And it's an amazing shower of particles that come down.
Yeah.
And this is a constant rain.
Yeah. But, and, of course, the high-intensity storms can reveal stress fractures. That's how they described it. Now, the researchers suggest that the 2015 storm triggered a phenomenon called magnetic reconnection, right, where the magnetic energy is simultaneously converted into kinetic energy, thermal energy, and particle acceleration. And in this instance, the process was powerful enough to open a crack through which a burst of cosmic rays slipped through. They are still continuing their work, and they're hoping that using GRAPES 3, it will offer an improved understanding of the stresses put on the magnetosphere by intense storms, and it will also help us to better predict vulnerabilities in the future.
Hmm. Yeah. That was pretty unique.
It is.
Nice find, too. Nice find.
Yeah, it's a very nice find. Now, where else can we go? We've done Mars.
When you think about those cosmic rays getting... See, when they hit high in the atmosphere, they're quite broken up by the time they get down to the Earth. So, you know, we're not hit heavy with the muons. But if they come closer, those are high-energy electrons. They break down into higher-energy electrons. You really don't want to be living in a bath of those.
Well, I'm just being panicked, pointed out to me, living near that hotspot won't help us. And
no.
Storm's got a point. Hang on a second. Let me put her point of view.
Because if Yellowstone goes, especially Old Faithful, everything you won't be able to see anything.
There you go.
Too much ash in the sky.
We're a long way from that thing going off.
Yes, thankfully. Now, another story, which is right up our alley on the event horizon, is a nearly naked black hole exposed by a galactic close encounter.
Did you get a chance to look at that one?
I've got the link ready.
That was above by the cluster. Like I said, I've been busy the last couple of weeks, haven't had a chance to get into my science. But oddly enough, you seem to be hitting some things I did catch a brief glimpse at.
Yeah. Now, this one is about supermassive black holes, which are usually hidden away at the center of galaxies.
Is there a video to go with that also, Nick?
There's an illustration.
I think there's a video to go with that.
Oh, I hope so.
Go ahead. I won't interrupt you anymore. I'm going to go collect the video for that. And post
yes,
it.
There is a video of this as well. And it's from NRAO. Now, the black hole is named B3 1715 plus 1.25. It's found near a cluster of galaxies called ZWCL8193. Now, the interesting thing is, they think that the black hole's home galaxy was stripped of material by a close encounter with a much larger galaxy. And what's left of the black hole's galactic clothing stretches about 3,000 light years across. Now, for comparison, the Milky Way is about 100,000 light years across. Now, the unmasked black hole is surprising, not just for its limited galactic insulation, but because the black hole is actually fleeing the close encounter at a speed of about 2,000 miles per second, still intact.
Yeah.
Well, normally what happens when two galaxies collide, more often than not, the resonant black hole becomes locked in orbit, they collide and merge. And we would get to know about this from the resulting gamma ray burst, which would be picked up by satellites, like the early Vela series, which confused quite a few people because they were set there to monitor for nuclear tests on the Earth. But even though there was no test, they were still reporting the telltale gamma radiation burst, and they couldn't figure out where it was coming for a very long time. And then somebody says, well, what if it isn't Earth generated? What if it's being generated from somewhere else in the universe? Eventually, the data got declassified and scientists got to grips with it, and that was the beginnings of pretty much a new branch of astronomy. So now we have equipment looking outwards that used to originally look inwards. And, well, it's kind of nice. It's trickle down. You've got military technology that was originally designed to monitor the test ban treaty being turned around, pointed in a different direction, and producing science. And this is going to be this is science that is helping us to understand the cosmos. I just think that is probably the biggest payback for tax dollars ever. Well, it's different.
Yeah. This is nice find, though. The radio telescope, there's a lot of radio telescope work going on now anyway.
Yeah.
That's one of the busier fields.
Radio astronomy.
Yeah, look at the size. Look at the size of the one China built. That thing is huge.
That thing took up a whole valley. Parkes
radio array. Mm. You got the square kilometer array. The one in Australia. You got the one in Africa.
Yeah.
And the unique thing about these places is they have to be in radio silence. And you've got the bird. I think the bird radio astronomy. Bird. It's named after one of the senators in the States. I'm sorry, I'm not from the States. I'm not familiar with the...
That's all right.
No, no.
I don't know who the senator is, right?
It was named after that gentleman. He collected the funding, and then something happened to the original one, and he managed to secure funding, get it rebuilt again. It fell down. They built it brand new. The largest dish, I think, suspended like over a building.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, Arecibo is still in use at the moment. I think the citizens of Puerto Rico are going to push for it to continue in use for a long time to come. And, of course, the other great thing is it's not just singular groups of telescopes. Radio telescopes across the world are now linking up together through interferometry. They are becoming a huge baseline. They're becoming one huge dish.
Well, that's what they do. They line them up. I've enjoyed listening to people explain that. I wish I could have remembered exactly what they did. They did a good job explaining it. I didn't do a good job of remembering, but they combine these arrays together and they make them one gigantic telescope the size of the Earth. That was cool, and they all got to work together. And those projects take so much time and so much interaction between different countries, different agencies. It takes months to set up, and it takes a lot of data collecting, data analysis, and when they're all done with the collecting on the project, they all work on the major project together, reviewing the data. But these systems are designed to work together. A telescope the size of the Earth, I never thought they could actually build something like that. thought it'd have to be optical. But no, it got explained really nicely by a professional, of course, that no, it's done with radio. That is just really cool. It's cool. That's the stuff about science that really gets to me. Well, I'm stuck in the math world, right? So these stories here, how you observe and measure our universe and the tools and the techniques and the excitement about getting together on these large projects, that grabs my attention. Trying to jump off the planet, well, good luck with that one.
Well, and you know what? As a member of the public, you can get involved in some of these projects. For instance, Starstormer sent us a link into the chat room. Citizen science jump aboard NASA's Jupiter mission to create amazing images. They're actually taking images from JunoCam and having people process the information. So there's a piece of software called Nuke, which is the foundry's Nuke composting. Got gardening on the brain for some reason. But what they're using, they are asking members of the public with computers who may not be using them overnight to join in and help create some of these amazing images of Jupiter. The link is in the chat room. Have a look. If you've got a computer and you're not using it overnight, join in. And you know what? This is going to be one of those missions that is probably going to really help change how we see the solar system. We have equipment on board Juno that can basically take a slice, like they're cutting a wedge out of a cake, to look down through the clouds.
How are we going to timestamp this? We're at the bottom of the hour now.
Yes, we are. Thank you very much, John. Thank you for reminding me. Okay, everybody, it is 9:30 p.m. in Eastern Standard Time. It is the bottom of the hour. You're listening to The Event Horizon, and we are live. We have all our friends in the chat room. We have got Twisted Edge, Starstorm, Glenn, Aqua Hello, for Glenn. You, and Black Projects in. Thank you, guys.
Excuse me? I got a link for Black Projects.
I've just been told I didn't mention Starstorm. Yes, I did. I mentioned you. But if you're listening to the podcast, go to the show notes and get the links. But if you can, we got a lot of them this week. That is right. And if you can join us live, come into the chat room, take part, put comments into chat. If you've got questions, we will try to answer them. Or if we don't answer them this week, we'll answer them next week.
Okay, I've got a link here for Mark Black Projects. He's brought us some. He's been talking about some dark energy, and I want to bring up a link here for him. This is a brand new one. This here deals with without having an energy component, you have a particle component for the dark matter. It's called a chameleon particle, and what's being measured and how and what they're doing actually at the moment to detect these chameleons. Mm-hmm. It's a unique little idea. And anyway, they're working with CERNs on this axiomatic telescope called CAST. And they're hoping to catch some of these chameleon particles. Right now, CAST is an experimental telescope. And it's designed to catch these rare exotic particles coming from the sun. And they have a little filament in there right now in their system. And they're trying to detect the pressure that these particles would be emanating just from the sun alone. But so far, they've detected none. So they're going to increase that. I think they're going to increase the sensitivity to the next system by a factor of 10. And it's part of the axiomatic search for components of dark matter and dark energy. But it's a unique one, which doesn't... It's a particle that would provide a negative pressure, which is what you're looking for. But it has a sliding mass, and that would be unique to physics, the fact that it has a sliding mass. What would I mean by sliding mass? The closer it is to an object, the less massive, or the more massive it would become. Mm-hmm. And the further away it's in like a void, the less mass it would be, and it would settle down. Nobody I'm aware of has any idea how a sliding mass like that would work. It would be a different technique in physics altogether. But it is one program that people are looking at to look at different alternatives for the dark component of the makeup of whatever our universe is. Like it's about 68% dark. It's just labeled as dark energy. And the other one's about 25% dark matter. And there's not much left over for us. Like 4% between hydrogen, helium, and 1% less than the stuff we can stand on. I think the stuff like Earth made out of makes up about 0.04% of the total energy component of the universe. Not much, eh? So I don't know where you're going to go stand when we get off the planet, but there's lots of helium gas and stuff to float around in.
This is true. Wasn't this originally one of Einstein's idea that if you put a substance with negative pressure pressure into the equations of general relativity,
that's why general relativity works backwards at large scale.
Yeah. It's amazing. Something like this is still so relevant today.
I was hoping he would enjoy that one.
Oh, yeah, I did. I actually saw this story earlier this week. And I read it during my breaks at work.
Well, that's the beauty of it. Most people want to claim, hey, it only goes this way and that's way. Well, no, it's not. There's many different ideas of how that goes together. Right now, that amount of dark energy is just, it's a component needed to explain the observations we see that have been, that come out since the 90s. Saul Perlmutter. He won the Nobel Prize, his team, for that one. And Alex Flipanenko, he was the other team. They chased another technique for measuring the expansion rate of the universe. And it came out that it needed an energy component of some sort that would make up for the pushing this pressure, negative pressure that's pushing the universe open.
Now, let me just quickly go check.
Nobody's saying exactly what it could possibly be, and that's the beauty of the subject. Whether it's a pure energy form, a scalar product like the Higgs fields, that's what it most likely is, like a scalar field. And that was confirmed that scalar fields exist in 2012 with the announcement of the Nobel Prize for the Higgs mechanism. July the 4th, the Higgs boson. Remember that one? They gave the prize. Actually, the prize is for the mechanism for the creation of mass, and the same mechanism gets used across larger scales, whole universe. So, yeah, there's a scalar component.
Well, I noticed that Brookhaven Lab Higgs hunter Sally Dawson has received the J.J. Sackery Prize for
Sackery Prize. Oh, that's a good one. That's
for theoretical particle physics.
Yeah.
So I'll put the link into chat.
Sackery Prize, that's a really good one.
Yeah. And it's nice. It's good to see that people are getting...
the Sackery is a very honorable prize. Yeah, that's top notch. That's Nobel stuff level.
Oh, yeah. And you know what? Without these prizes, I think that a lot of the people who may not have actually been, say, in the Alpha team, are getting the recognition.
Oh, there's many prizes out there besides Nobel. Yeah. Nobel's not the, well, people want to put it on the top pedestal. It's not on the top. It used to have a nice luster to it. But the science ones, oh, yeah. You always get to enjoy them. Humanities, but there's other prizes that have no controversy attached to them, should have. The Run Shaw Prize, that's the Asian Nobel. You got the Abel Prize, that's a math one. That's the equivalent of the Nobel, not the Fields. The Fields is a younger prize for under 40. Actually, the Fields Medal is for under 40 years old in math. It's more of a bribe. And it's an excellent prize to get in math. But it was a bribe to keep the younger people in, because usually by 40 you're saying, I had enough of this, I'm getting out. It was like, no, please stick around, we need your talent, and your talent has been exceptional. A lot of times they were being taken away by industry would just absorb. So in order to keep math alive, they try to make a really super prize, a decent prize, that so they kept it for under 40. Now Andrew Wiles, he missed his because he was a little over 40 when he got Fermat's Last Theorem with Richard Taylor, right? Yeah. So they have a special medal, a medallion, Fields medallion, if you're, because it was such a Fermat's last problem, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was such an amazing thing to finally accomplish that they had to give Andrew something. Anyway, Richard Taylor got the Fields. Andrew got a medallion. They made a special medallion. But it's a bribe, and it's a good thing for under 40. But people say, yeah. Oh, if you're too old, it's no good. Well,
I think that's unfair in some respects, saying you're too old, because...
It's not. It's what you've done in the field. It's your accomplishments in the field and what you've done, how you've moved the field forward.
And let's face it, people like Suskin are still active. There's so many people...
That's the thing. When you stay in physics and math, why is it your brain keeps working?
Coincidence? No.
No, it's because you want to know what's going on. Your brain won't let go. It wants to...
When you're 24-7, you're 24-7. It just doesn't stop. All right.
Age is not a barrier to actually making the discovery of something or even seeing something that in the right time and place, which leads on to a major discovery. Yeah. So, as I say...
When you're 24-7, you're 24-7. There's not a lot you can do about it. Now, you just have to pick a healthy subject. And
this is true.
Dealing with the universe is not really a healthy subject. So you stick with math. Science can get on your nerves, so you don't really, really want to spend a lot of time, especially in the quantum mechanics area. There's such a... It's polluted. There's really not a decent conversation about quantum mechanics out there on the internet. Without an argument. Most of the quantum mechanics now that you're getting on YouTube wants a deterministic outlook, and while the universe is not deterministic, but they're working hard at it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not really a good enough subject. If you're 24-7, that conversation is not healthy. Healthy, I mean mentally, okay?
Okay.
Most of science is like that.
A couple of questions.
Trying to make contact with the universe, it's not that healthy.
Couple of questions in the chat room. One is from Starstorm. She's asked, could you possibly measure continental movement, continents moving, by the position of certain constellations over an extended period of time? The only issue with using constellations is...
They move.
They move.
Yeah.
And they change. If you look at something like, for instance, Ursa Major... It's been nicknamed very different things. It's been called Charles's Wain, the Plough, the large saucepan, because the stars are in relative motion in regards to us. What is the current pattern now in the future will be a very different one. So it's not really something you could actually use for that. GPS works good, yes. In fact, that's what they use on a lot of the large volcanoes on Earth. They're looking for minute changes on the GPS position to alert them to a potential to the buildup of magma. Now, the other question is do you dream math, John?
Yes.
There you go, Aqua. You got your answer.
That's why I stated what I stated.
But as I say, science is one of these wonderful things. It can...
Science is not the terminal conversation. There's stuff beyond science.
Exactly.
But sometimes it's distracted from math and physics. Okay? Mm. There's math beyond the math that you get for math and physics. Okay? The subject itself. There's this subject called math and physics together. Picture a puddle. This puddle is on a sidewalk. And the puddle starts to evaporate a little bit. And there's a little dark edge around where this puddle used to be on the sidewalk. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
You get that part? That little evaporated edge stain, that's science. The sidewalk itself, that's the universe. This whole mass that sits in the center is called math and physics. And they've extracted the tools from math and physics to work the edge where it's science and science makes contact with how we populate space and time with particles, how planets move, how the grass grows,
mm-hmm.
how flowers grow. All that science is extracted from math.
But
the mass itself is different.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you there. The math itself is different. See, math is a language. Okay, that part I'll agree with. Math is a language, and it's used to, and it's a language humans have learned, and they use it to describe how they observe and measure the natural world around them. Okay, then there's another language called mass. This language, it too is a human language, but this language was learned by listening to the language that math uses to describe itself. That is where it gets a little heavy. Physics is the same thing. There's applied mathematics, which is physics, and that's used to observe and measure the natural world around us. Behaviors and predictions, its energy and matter, and its coordinate system, all within a personal reference frame. Okay? Then there's this other physics. This physics here, again, it's a language, it's a human language, but it's the language that humans picked up from listening to the language that physics uses to describe itself.
Mm-hmm.
This physics that's describing itself and this math that describes itself is older than old. Okay? Math itself is older than the universe. Now, there's the real deal, okay? Someone finally said the real deal, okay? That's all it is.
Mm-hmm.
Take it for whatever you want. So when you have these two intersections, this middle puddle, and it's a hybrid of math and physics, theoretical physics, that's where everybody's at. There's very few people. That's where your string theories are at, your quantum field theories.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of the story is easy to explain from there. But there's not many people that refer themselves as string theory, that are working on trying to make contact with the particle species we have at the LHC. I think all of last year, there was, Eva Silverstein, I guess she was the only one that was at any conference that talked about strings in that formulation. Right now, it's strings. It's how it deals with number theory, how it deals with algebra, how it deals with geometry. And none of those things have anything to do with the science we do every day.
Mm-hmm.
The topologies. Some reason, it's been since 85, 90, people have been discovering how math and physics at this level is talking to each other. And once you experience that, you're really not interested in going doing a lot of science and moving test tubes around and beakers. It's really amazing. And how is it that math can capture the symmetries, a function can capture the symmetries of and the vibrations of a string, and the string evolves with the symmetries of the space and time we see, and how strings, when you take strings, you get a gauge field theory. You get the math of gauge fields, which is all of the standard particles, all the standard model. That's the math formulation the standard model of physics relies on. And you get general relativity. It falls right out of the equation. Natural decompositions. You just hit that a couple of times and you're like, oh, wow. Has life ever changed? And it's fun.
Mm. And
so if you're looking for everybody, that's where they're at.
Now, on a slightly similar subject, I put a link into the chat room. And this is actually a question that was asked an astrophysicist. Gillian Scudder was asked this question. When two galaxies collide, they eventually coalesce to form a larger galaxy. But by far, most of the mass of a galaxy is dark matter, which feels no friction and suffers not from collisions. Why then do not the dark matter components of the galaxy simply pass to each other and continue going? This is just the original question was, why don't galaxies just pass to each other instead of colliding? Now, the link is in the chat room, and they've got a very good illustration of an interacting pair of galaxies. It's actually ARP 81 or NGC 6621/2. Now, it's seen at about 100 million years after their closest approach. So NGC 6621 is on the left, and 662 is on the right. 6621 is the larger of the two, and is a very disturbed spiral galaxy now. Now, a lot of it, your typical galaxy has much more mass in its dark matter reservoir than it has in its stars. Unfortunately for us observers, stars are the only visible parts of a galaxy, with the exception of a few nearby galaxies, where we can actually measure how much of this dark matter is hanging around. This is an interesting article. It's worth a good read, because the dark energy, dark matter question is still one that is relevant today, and it may help. Did you get a chance to look at the link, John?
Well, dark matter really just clumps.
Mm.
The Bullock Cluster, those are two galaxies that went through each other. The gas went with it, but the dark matter clumped in the center. That's pretty neat. So I wonder if it's the same situation. No, I didn't see that one. That's in Forbes?
That's on Forbes, yes. Now, as I say, the interesting thing is, with this setup, you could expect two blobs of dark matter to simply pass through each other if they're on a collision course. And yet, we see that the galaxies do collide, but what happens to the dark matter? Does it just accumulate, get to pull into a reservoir around the new enlarged galaxy? A lot of people would have thought that if these two objects are moving too quickly relative to each other, they should just slingshot past one another, never to encounter again. But it seems to me that what happens in a lot of these occasions is you have repeated passes.
What I understand it to be. You have,
yeah,
like how we captured a lot of our globular clusters and stuff were stripped out galaxies.
Yeah,
most simulations I see, they keep passing back and forth and splash, but they're
And that's one of the things they think is going to happen between the Milky Way and Andromeda. It won't be just one major head-on collision.
They don't think these galaxies are going to do that?
Well, the simulations vary depending on obviously on what the inputs you give, the figures you give. But it seems to me that a lot of what's being said and seen is the fact you have a repetitive series of collisions until in the end they do merge. And of course, one of the things that's going to happen then is you're going to get a starburst effect. You're going to get quite a few new stars.
So that'll count for starburst. Okay, good deal.
Yeah, because if you think about it, it's something has to create the compression of
you need
the,
yeah you need
gas.
From what I've seen in the latest simulations, you need black holes and you need gas. If you don't have black holes in galaxies, you get a lot of star formation, and they'll just turn all the stars and grow it out. And if you have too many black holes, it inhibits.
Yeah.
So if you get the balance of black holes and gas right, you'll get galaxy formations as we see today. In simulations that'll turn out to be the galaxy. See, there seems to be a relationship between the amount of black holes needed for the galaxy in order for to control the star formation. I don't know about control star formation. I think I got that one wrong. But I guess it will. It will control it from running away. It'll prevent a runaway effect. That's about all I can really say there. Sorry.
But I'm beyond
my pay grade there.
I think with this one, we all are. But you know what? It's an interesting article. And it really does make you think about what's going on. Because the interesting thing is, where you've had galaxies doing this, not quite colliding head-on as of yet, but passing each other and repassing each other to heading towards a collision, you do get the compression in the medium. And we are seeing these star nurseries coming to existence. So something, even for the one in Orion, it isn't just chance, perhaps the chance compression of gas. Something would have had to affected that gas cloud.
Well, there should be a relationship on what I am familiar with galaxies collide with gravity. It's a heavier density wave, and it's a slower, the black holes are slower to coalesce, right? So it produces a constant high frequency or heavy wave of gravity, that will have an effect on the makeup of star stuff too. In particular, possibly the smaller stuff, the planetoids, anything under a meter, I guess I'm referring to as a planetoid.
Yeah.
Last time I read, the collisional gravitational energy involved in two galaxies colliding may also provide a way to get this material over the 1 meter limit. Now, there's not a complete understanding of how material grow bigger than 1 meter. Once it's past 1 meter, it'll keep growing up into planets and or moonlets and planets and that stuff. But to get it over that 1 meter mark, it takes quite a bit of right conditions.
Mm-hmm.
And the two galaxies, big galaxies colliding and producing a heavy enough density wave may offer an opportunity for that. I didn't say that did, but I've read. When I read that stuff, no one ever says, hey, this is exactly how it goes. It's just, no. This is another scenario, a possible.
And the thing is, M31 and Andromeda have already passed each other once. And, of course, the Milky Way gets its attendant galaxies and stuff by this. Sometimes they go into an orbit around us, or they get stripped. And I suppose this is really where we need to be sitting outside of the galaxy to observe the process. It is one that happens over huge, vast amounts of time.
But it'll go so fast, no simulations, huh? You just watch them swirl.
Oh, yeah. You watch the simulations. It's very, very fast. But it is obviously how in the past we got...
just follow the laws of physics.
Follow the laws of physics, yes.
That's all it's doing, is just follow the laws of physics. And that's why it's important to get the right chemical makeup.
Yeah. Good point. Bat Projects has a good point. Centaurus was an external galaxy that got mugged violently in the process. And, of course, one of the things we have found, there are black holes which exist outside of galactic centers. So we have these black holes which are roaming the universe, literally.
Well, there's models.
Yeah.
There's models right now that have the dark component.
Yeah.
As small black holes and stuff.
Yeah. Well,
I don't know. I don't pick any favorites.
Yeah. Well, I think one of them had them as being a froth of black holes.
Yeah.
So there is plenty of ideas out there. And eventually they'll get tested properly. They'll be discarded. They may come back in a new form.
Yeah, that's not how I go about NASA. See, we always bump across stuff that's not obviously wrong yet, and you just keep finding out why it's wrong. And then, hey, I got it. It's wrong, right? But to just bump your head or in a shower and just go, oh, I know how the universe goes together. That's a little foreign to me.
Mm-hmm.
But, I guess inflation, Andre Linde thought he'd come up with that. In math and the rest of the world, it's like, you find something that's not obviously wrong, and you keep digging at it. Why isn't this wrong?
Yeah.
Well, eventually you find out why it is, and they go, well, it's not. And this is why it's not wrong. And you discover something new and amazing. That's all of math is written in that direction. Similar. You don't get a bright idea out of the blue.
No, it's something you have to work away at for a long period of time.
I said that absolutely wrong. I don't know how you jump ahead. But physics allows you to gives you that magic ability to jump ahead in thought and grasp and work your way back. And that's the beauty of mixing math and physics together.
This is true. And of course, it's more and more the way forward, maths and physics, not just physics, not just anything else. You have to have the underpinnings.
You try some Moonshine Monster math, right? That stuff there, that's rock and roll today.
Yeah,
that's where everybody's at. That's the younger generation right now. That's pure rock and roll.
Well, I can hear music faintly in the background, so we are getting close to that time. I really hope that you have enjoyed the show this week. And so, you know what? It's been great. John, it's been brilliant having you. We've had some fun here. Moonshine Matt, I think Moonshine, you're going to have to tell us some more about next time. Get us some links for that, so that we can get to grips with it. So, you know, it is that time. It's nearly that time, folks. John, any final thoughts?
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys. I jumped on quickly. Dylan from Marty. Hope you're getting lots of good looks in the sky, Marty.
Right, it's time to... the communicator's gone off. We have to beam up. Three of us to beam up.
We hope that you've enjoyed this program from AFM Radio, the broadcast service of astronomy.fm. This program has been released under Creative Commons license. Please contact us for details. You may find more of our AFM original programs on our website. It's really easy to find us. We are astronomy.fm. You may also find us in the iTunes radio listings near the top of the news talk section, and also as an iTunes podcast selection. We'd love to hear your comments. Please email us at radio@astronomy.fm. Thanks so much for being part of the voice of astronomy around the world and across the known universe. This is astronomy.fm radio.
Hi, this is Tavi Greiner, Astronomy.fm's Vice President of Communications. If you enjoy our programming, please let us know with a donation to astronomy.fm/donate. We really do rely on your support, and it's true, every little bit counts.
AFM. There I was, doing my thing. And all of a sudden, wham! Astronomy right between the eyes.